A poem told through the eyes or keys of an abandoned piano sits alongside ones about fallen angels, forgotten women, and even an astronaut in Cantabrian Joanna Preston's second poetry collection, Tumble. She uses a variety of poetic genres, from traditional short forms to expansive free verse. Joanna's first collection, The Summer King, won two prizes, the inaugural Kathleen Grattan Award for Poetry and the 2010 Mary Gilmore Award. Joanna, who's also an editor, starts our interview with a poem from Tumble.
Silks. She straddled the ridge cap. Against her legs, the day's warmth, trapped in the roof tiles, felt comforting, almost alive. Nearby, someone was burning leaves, a sweet smell like toffee. Across the fences, the trees were in autumn's silks, russet and gold, chestnut and bay. She gripped lightly with her knees as she'd been taught. She didn't want wings. She wanted to fly on the thunder of hooves, feel muscles surging beneath her. The word in her head matching stride, freedom, freedom, freedom. As she bent low over the withers, pressing her cheek against the finial's neck, her own hair a mane streaming wild in the wind.
Joanna, with this collection, I mean, you're trying all these different poetic styles and lots of different stories and perspectives are being told, but do you think ultimately there's a theme here or several themes that you're exploring?
It sort of came together as a way of looking at the journey from, I suppose, innocence to experience, really. The idea of the many different paths that you travel as a young woman to becoming whoever you are as an adult, whoever you become. The ideas of starting out when you don't really understand what's going on, but you're trying to find your way. And then, yeah, coming into your own sense of who you are, your own sense of power, your own sense of agency, and then being able to sort of look back and go, okay, yeah, I could have gone that way, I could have gone this way, but I went this way instead. So that's the basic idea behind the collection.
You often use your imagination to become even what we would see as an inanimate object. And I'm thinking about, in a way, the piano, the elephant in the parlour. The piano did not expect this. I just love that poem. And it's, I was going to say it's tricksy, but it's you play with us and the piano's memories. Quite lovely. Is that something you enjoy? You look at something and imagine what life could be like from its perspective.
Oh, constantly. I'm also one of those sad people who gives names to everything. I love trying to see the world through someone else's eyes, through something else's eyes. And particularly with musical instruments. I used to play clarinet when I was a kid, and I sort of grew up in a family that loved music. And instruments have their own character and their own personality. I mean, they feel like they have their own soul. And so, yeah, I had no trouble with the piano trying to get into its head. I could imagine a piano that had been, you know, played by generations and generations and then neglected, and thinking about how it might look at the world.
I have to believe that there is indeed a portrait of great Aunt Lavinia.
There sort of is. She's an amalgam of a couple of my great-great aunts. As much as anything, it's that idea of that indomitable, almost bigger-than-life character that I think every family has. One of those women who very much goes her own way, no matter what it does to the rest of the family. But yes, she's an amalgam of lots of people. But yeah, I did have one or two specific events in mind for that one.
A few moments of revenge here too. I'm very taken with the seamstress. She has her revenge on her partner on the way out and the end of the relationship.
Oh, yes. And that one is best read with Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son playing in the background.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, that one was great fun. Yes, I love sewing, and I just had this idea about, I can't remember who I was in conversation with. We were talking about the different sorts of revenge that different people could take, and how if you did this, if you were a chef, there's always the, you know, the idea of wreaking a real havoc in a sort of almost Medea fashion on your partner if you wanted to, or if you were a policeman, you could sort of get them framed for a crime. You know, all of these lovely stories that you sort of joke with your girlfriends about. And I just thought, oh, the seamstress, what could you do? And I thought that was a nice poetic revenge without doing too much damage, just leaving him with no flies in his trousers. That was good.
The Ministry of Sorrow feels like a very different kind of poem, and I just wanted to explore it with you.
Yeah, it's one of the the sort of sequence of earthquake poems that I wrote. There was so much that was happening in Christchurch at that time, but also I had a lot of things going on in my family life. Both of my grandmothers died around that time. And I'd just found out that a friend from school had died, and it was just all of these things coming together. And then there was this reference in the newspaper to someone who'd been into the centre of the city, I think when very early on in the opening up of the red zone, and saying how we didn't really deal well with sorrow, that we didn't have, we had a minister for recovery, but we didn't have a minister for sorrow, and that we should do. And that got me thinking about the way that we're not very good at dealing with sorrow. We tend to run away from it. And if you do that, you never quite face up to it. And sometimes you just have to say, okay, this is the thing that has happened. This is the loss that we've faced, and you have to sort of deal with that. So the poem took quite a long time to write. I think I really only finished it just before we launched the earthquake anthology back in, 2016. So yes, it has a lot of different ripples running through it. Some of them are my losses, some of them are the losses of friends and people that I knew, and just all of it with the devastation that Christchurch went through and still goes through. So yes, it's a poem that was quite hard to write and took a lot of drafts and a lot of redrafts. But yeah, I think it's found its final form.
I'm so weary with poets of assuming the autobiographical when I'm reading poems, because that use of I is prolific. But when I'm reading, when you take us to the fields of Flanders, that feels to me, and even with the structure of it, it's not a traditional poetic structure of this, it more looks more paragraph than poem. But is this a story from your whānau?
Yeah, that one is all 100% literally true. The forms are a haibun, which is an old Japanese thing that predates the English prose poem. So the idea is you have these large sections of poetic prose with a haiku embedded in it. Yeah, Listentok was absolutely what happened. I've probably got the wrong family relation. I always think of him as my great-great uncle, but I think my mother would probably correct me and tell me no, he's something like third cousin twice removed or something like that. But I did literally read his diaries that he'd sent back from the war, and yeah, he died in Listentok in just the way I said, which was it was an amazing place to go to. Apparently it's changed enormously. When we were there, it was very, very simple and very, very beautiful. And we were the only people there. My husband and I were the only people visiting. And so you just have this enormous, enormous field of crosses and of headstones. And it's just mind-blowing and horrifying and incredibly moving.
Such a sad line when you have that his full name, place of birth, the names of his parents and his home written in a ledger almost too heavy for me to lift. That just got me, that line.
Yeah, and it genuinely was. I mean, my mother had actually found the reference to where he'd been buried online and had sent me with all of these instructions about what to photograph and what to do. And then as we were leaving, I found the ledger where they had the lists of everybody who was buried and where they were. And yeah, exactly as it says, that where he was born, where he grew up, what his home was. And it's the number of names. There's just a huge, huge loss of life. The scale of it is mind-blowing. And yeah, that idea of the book being too heavy to lift was literally true, but also works quite nicely as a metaphor. But yeah, it's an astonishing place.
Metaphor is throughout the collection, and I started reading The Dollhouse and ended up in a different direction. I've never been fond of dollhouses or dolls, I'll be honest. I find them disconcerting for some reason. But that's a really a sad little poem.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that one is not autobiographical, because otherwise my mother will phone me up and say, Joanna, you needed to make that clear. But it's that idea of the parents and the children not quite living in each other's world, which I find really, really fascinating. The whole idea of how little we know other people, even especially our parents, I think. You never quite see your parents as real people when you're growing up. And then all of a sudden, one day, you say, "Oh, they are. They're a human just like I am." And that was quite an odd thing. But with that, yes, with this poem, I was just trying to play with that idea of how you how you manage the relationship, how you interact with each other, and yeah, the simple fact that kids so often play out their family dramas and family traumas with their dolls or their toys or things like that.
Joanna Preston, Tumble is published by Otago University Press.